Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's Diego Alfonso, airline transport pilot, designated pilot examiner, with over 13,000 hours of dual given from Orlando, Florida, who is today's host.
Hello, everyone. My name is Diego Alfonso, and I'm here with the Florida Aviation Network. Our next guest his name is Steve McCooey. I hope I got that right. And he is the executive producer of the Seaplane Pilot Association here in Florida. And he's a native of Florida. He lives in Winter Haven. And he has taken time off his busy schedule to chat with us a little bit here. So, Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Diego. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, this seaplane thing, I've always wanted to get my seaplane rating, but I don't know how to swim.
So well, we can
I guess
work
that's
on that.
That's a big problem there. But anyway, no. Seriously, I have all the ratings and never got my seaplane rating. So that's going to be one of the things out of my, what do you call that,
the bucket list. Well, we can facilitate that. I might know someone that can make a seaplane rating
sure.
happen
well,
for you.
Here, to boot, I'm a pilot examiner. I'm a very good friend of Jack's. And with the Browns, actually Chuck and I, we went to school together.
Oh, super.
And, but for some reason, I have been evading them or they've been evading me. So at any rate, I'm really glad that you're here today because I believe you have quite a bit of information that you can pass along to our viewers and all the seaplane pilots and all the seaplane pilots to be
yes.
that they want to be, and who else to pass that information along better than you. So could you please
great.
Tell us a little bit of history on that and what are your plans are and what is in the works?
Well, the first thing, you know, a lot of people don't realize how easy it is to get a seaplane license, and there's a lot of benefits to doing so. You know, one of the things, any additional rating counts as a BFR. And so by getting a seaplane rating, you can accomplish your BFR as part of the process. But also, more importantly, it really has a way of teaching people and getting people back in touch with real stick and rudder skills. Getting in a J3 club like you would do at Jack Brown Seaplane Base. You know, one of the things that is very common that we'll immediately notice that people are sloppy with their stick and rudder skills. And so whether you're in a commercial pilot program or whether you're a recreational pilot, it's really beneficial to go ahead and get a seaplane rating to work on those skills and develop skills that in today's glass environments we're not necessarily teaching people as they do so. And the beauty of these ratings is that you can do a seaplane rating in 2 to 3 days and about 6 hours of training, generally for under $2,000. So it's a fairly inexpensive add-on rating. It really sets you apart with your peers because only about 3% of pilots have their seaplane rating. So it really sets you apart with your peers, and you have the most fun you'll ever have flying.
Definitely. One of the things that I noticed, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, most of the seaplane pilots, they don't go up very high, do they?
No. Well, yeah, we laugh because if you're over 1,000 feet, a seaplane pilot will be screaming at you that he's getting a nosebleed. So, yeah, we're generally, we stay very low, which is something that people have to get used to. It's funny because you literally, when I have to force myself to go above 1,000 feet above the ground because you do get very comfortable flying low and slow. A lot of times when we're over water, you're flying a couple feet over the ground or over the water. So
that's right.
It's beautiful.
I guess the good thing about this is, and I don't know this for a fact, but I've been told that the seaplane, especially the one with floats, that you can actually land on land as you could land on water if you have to.
If you had to, yeah. A lot of times what we'll do is, if you have an engine failure per se, a grass strip is fine, a field is fine. Even if you do have to choose pavement, there's a keel strip on the bottom of the floats, and it's usually sacrificial, so it causes very little, if any, damage that's permanent. A lot of times, even for maintenance, when someone has a straight float airplane, they'll just bring the airplane in and land it on the grass just to bring it in for maintenance. And then to take it back off, what we'll do is put it on a trailer, tow the trailer behind a truck, and lift off of the trailer.
Oh. Michelle, would you ever consider getting a seaplane rating?
Well, it depends. How old do you have to be to have one? Do you have to be like my age, 15?
Yeah, as long as you have your private pilot's license and you can actually go and get your seaplane pilot's license even without having your private, you could do your sea rating before you did your land rating if you chose to do so.
Interesting, because it's different. Is it different than flying in like a regular plane than a seaplane, or is there any real difference at all?
Well, here again, you're going to have a lot more stick and rudder skills. You're going to be used to flying very low to the ground. But things that will be different when you get into J3, you spin the prop. You start the airplane by hand propping it in many instances. It's not uncommon for a seaplane not to have a radio or a artificial horizon. So there'll be a lot of, it'll be a lot more stick and rudder skills, a lot more seat of the pants type flying. So it makes you a grassroots aviator is one of the things I like to tell people.
I see.
Okay. I really think that doing that kind of flying sharpens your skills even more.
It does.
Than just being a land pilot, because like I said, every time I see a seaplane, I see the airplane flying low, and I mean, if anything happens, you gotta act quick. I mean, the decision making mm-hmm. process has to be rather quick. But being that is like par for the course,
mm-hmm.
those instincts are better suited once you get that rating and you get to practice all that low flying.
Yeah, there's different levels of complexity of seaplanes. We have the basic J3s, but we fly everything up to the Grumman Albatrosses. So, you'll have complex airplanes as well, but one of the things in instilling these skills is that in a J3 you don't have flaps. So you get used to approaches without flaps. When you're in the water, you're like land. You're steering with your feet, with the rudders. You'll have water rudders, but you have to use them. You very aggressively have to use them. So it does instill these skills. You'll get used to flying low. You won't be, intimidated that you're in the, when you come over a lake, you come in very low over the trees, and that's by design. And there's different types of landings on water, kind of like a tailwheel airplane, where there'll be glassy water, which is actually more difficult to land on than water that has waves. When it's perfectly smooth, it's actually more challenging to land on. Yeah. So there's techniques for accomplishing that. There's rough water landings and normal landings. So you'll go through the same procedures like a short field takeoff or a soft field takeoff.
Right.
You'll do the same thing on water, which a lot of people don't understand.
One thing that I saw a video clip a while back, and there were like three or four T6s.
Mm-hmm.
And the landing gear was extended, and they were like skiing on the water. Is that a camera?
Cringe at that. Yes. No, I cringe at that. Can you do it? Yes. Obviously, do we recommend it? No.
No, I understand that. I was just curious to know, because there was no explanation.
Yeah.
I just saw the clip. And yeah. I wonder, since you're in the water business, if that is, number one, if it's possible, if it's true.
Yeah, you can actually do that. A lot of the guys with the big balloon tires for the Alaska flying and the bush flying will ski across the top of the water. But very, very precise control of the airplane. And probably not the best thing to
yeah.
do.
Now that you mention Alaska, I visited there a few years ago, and my gosh, that seaplane population of the world must be over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it's a very dense seaplane population area for it. Actually, we are here in Florida as well. We have a very large seaplane. And, of course, in Florida, we're surrounded on three sides by water. And when you get in the interior of Florida, mm-hmm. there's lakes and rivers everywhere. But I'll be up in Alaska first week of May. So after we get done with Sun and Fun, I've got about 2 weeks. And then I head up to Alaska to start the season up there as well.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to watch a couple fly-ins. And my gosh, there were seaplanes from all over the place and all kinds, all shapes. And which that reminds me when I see this the splashing over here. And could you tell us that it's something about the splashing that is going in here in Sanford?
Yeah.
I mean, in Lakeland.
In here at Sun and Fun. Well, you know, one of the great things we have about Sun and Fun is, number one, there's a very large seaplane population that's parked on the field here, and it's in the Seabirds parking area, which is on the east side of the airport. But every Thursday of every Sun and Fun, we do a splash-in. And this year it'll be held at the location that we've had it for many years, which is over at Fantasy of Flight, which is another great partner for the event. And last year we had 105 seaplanes in the water.
Wow.
At one location. And we do takeoff and landing competitions, and we do bomb drop or grapefruit drop contests where we try to hit a target as we fly over it. And it, you know, that is a really good place to come out and just hang out with seaplane pilots, to talk to people about what it's like to have the rating, what it's like to own an airplane or to use the rating. It's all day Thursday. The events start around noon, but I would recommend people come out around 9 o'clock in the morning. The airplanes start coming in force, and it's literally an all-day event. So it's a lot of great flying out there.
I understand you're going to be there.
Yes, I get the good fortune to go there, and I hope it's a great experience. Now, are there different kinds of seaplanes, or is there just like one kind of seaplane? Because with regular planes, you have like different kinds for different purposes. Are there like any other kinds of seaplanes?
Well, there is. There'll be your straight float airplanes, which can only land on water. There'll be amphibious float planes, which have retractable landing gear, so you can land on runways just as easily as the water. And then you have flying boats, and those flying boats can, here again, either be without landing gear, or where they're only for landing on water, or they can be amphibious. The Grumman Albatross is a perfect example, and thankfully I've had the good fortune to fly albatrosses, and I'm type rated in them. We actually got married in one in flight.
Oh my God.
There's a variety, and each fly differently. If you learn how to fly seaplanes in a float plane, there's a completely different set of techniques that you'll use in an airplane that's a hull type aircraft.
And will all of those be at the splash-in?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
There'll be
that's
a good representation of all those types of aircraft at the splash-in on Thursday.
Right.
So, in your opinion, which one of those is easier to fly, the float or the boat type, the hull type?
They have their own unique characteristics. Is it easier or more difficult? They're not really easier or more difficult. It's just a different technique.
Right.
The floats far outnumber the hull type aircraft, but. You have the Sea Ray, the Sea Max, you have the Adventura. You have a lot of LSAs that are coming along that are hull aircraft. So we're seeing more activity in the hull area, but floats have always been the dominant side of the seaplane world. So
yeah.
There's a lot more float planes than there
I
are
had
hull
the
planes.
Opportunity many, many years ago when you could ride almost in the cockpit, and we went from Miami to the Bahamas, remember?
Oh, over in Chalks.
And it's a shame, you know, that those things are out of the picture, I believe.
Well, it's interesting. The Chalks ceased operation after their spar failure, which was really unfortunate because at the time, and this was a true tragedy for us as seaplane pilots and I think the aviation community, was that Chalks was the oldest airline in continuous operation in the world.
Yep.
They were also the safest airline. They had never had a passenger fatality. And so what's really a shame is that the first event ended the service of the airline. And there is a group of people that are interested in bringing Chalks back in some form. And we're seeing a dramatic increase in the amount of commercial and private activity going to the Bahamas. There's a airline down in Key West seaplanes that will take you out around the islands. We have another operation out of Fort Lauderdale International that's operating over to Bimini in the Bahamas and also down in the Keys called Tropic Ocean Airways.
Right.
They just expanded their fleet. They just added a caravan on amphibs.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of activity.
I think that those trips to the Bahamas, nothing better than going either in an amphib or a seaplane. I mean, it's just water is a natural element that you're flying over it. And
it's
and
wonderful.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. I think that Chuck was such a legend, you know.
It was.
Actually, it was a legend.
I grew up with him. I was in Fort Lauderdale and grew up with the airline, you know. So
I had the opportunity to fly one time, and I remember seeing the guy up here trying to do these things and then bouncing in the water and all that. It was very, very interesting. I remember that. And although it was many, many, many years ago, I remember like it was yesterday.
And that was the what caused a lot of the flying hull type designs to be formed was the hulls typically could handle bigger water. So Chalks operated both the Grumman Albatross and the Grumman Mallard. And they would handle a little bit larger water, and they were operating out of Government Cut down in Miami, out of the water, and then flying into Bimini and other places.
Yep.
But what we do is once or twice a year, we take a group of 15 to 20 seaplanes, and we'll go over to the Bahamas, and we'll tour the islands. And the Bahamians love seeing the seaplanes come back. So it's
that's my favorite place to go is the Bahamas. I'm originally from Cuba.
Okay.
So I was born and raised on a beach. And so I've never been back since I left and 50 some years ago. And whenever I enjoy going around down there, you know, the walkers and the abacos, the whole chain there, Cherokee Bay and all that, it's just beautiful. And I see a lot of seaplane activity. I see actually people that land and they just beach the airplane. I mean, that's got to be really, really, really something.
It's an amazing experience.
Just that looks
or
fun.
Fish. You know, just stop and do some fishing and then get
go snorkeling, pull up to a conch bar and have some conch salad or some conch fritters. It's just wonderful.
They're great for the islands, I guess.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
Steve, tell us something about the association itself. For instance, if I want to join the association, what is it that I have to do, or are there any requirements?
No. Joining the association is very easy. You can come by our booth. We're in Hangar C, and this we're at booth number 76 and 77 in Hangar C. You can also look us up at seaplanes.org and join there. And we'll have a pretty large presence here at the show, but essentially it's $45 a year, which is similar to EAA and AOPA, and we work very closely with both EAA and OPA as well. We do a full-color glossy magazine. Currently, we're producing that 8 times a year. So with your membership, you get the full-color glossy magazine. You get myself, our field directors, and our staff out there fighting and working to promote and protect seaplane access. So we work with local, state, and federal agencies to ensure that we have access to water to use for seaplanes.
Mm-hmm.
We have a scholarship program, which is fairly new to the association. If you're a member, a paid member of the association, you can apply as a young person. We're really targeting 17 to 25-year-olds and that are career track pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a zero cost seaplane rating if you win the award, and it is done on merit. And we'll be awarding one at Sun and Fun this year. So we go around the country, and it's a zero cost seaplane rating. Whatever it takes for you to get your rating, you can apply and receive the award.
So young adults are part of the association too.
Absolutely. And you know, as we see with the pilot population, you know, there's this sense that, you know, there's a lot of white-haired gentlemen in the aviation community. No offense, Diego. But we need to make sure that there's young people coming along.
Yes.
We need to be fostering young people. And this is what I'm so excited about you being involved, Michelle. It's wonderful.
I wish I was more involved.
Well, we're going to work on that.
We're
going to work on that. And when we're talking about younger people, you know, it instills the sciences. It instills math skills. So it really gives them the skills you're going to need to go forward in life. And I love telling this story. I actually started very young, and I hope to be an inspiration for other people to start. When I was 10 years old, I was in fifth grade. My best friend was Michael Wagner, and his father was a pilot for National Airlines, so I'll date myself there because National Airlines hasn't been around for a long time.
Right.
I got the names and addresses of 200 airlines.
Wow.
And I hand-typed a letter to each one of the airlines and said, I'm 10 years old, my name is Steve McCaughey, and I'm interested in flying for a living and pursuing aviation as a career. Can you help me? Can you give me advice, and what should I do? And so I ended up getting personal responses back from the president of Braniff, Eastern, and Delta. And then at 12, I would tell my parents I was going over to one of my friend's house. I would go off on my bike, but I was really going to Dunkin' Donuts, and I would stop and get two dozen donuts. And then I'd ride up to Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport, and I would pick up the phone at the base of the control tower and say, guys, I've got donuts. Can I come up? And so they would say, sure.
I was going to say, I bet you never got no for an answer.
Yeah. So what I would do is I'd go up to the control tower. They would give me a headset and binoculars, and I would sit up there and learn all day. And then at 15, I started taking lessons. And I would work a week in a pet store.
Yep.
To get an hour of flight lessons. You know, I would earn the money to go take that 1 hour of flying time every.
So it just shows you that anybody can do this no matter what age.
Yeah.
You can get started no
matter
when.
Whether you have your parents' assistance or not. I mean, at that time, you know, I was making $2.35 an hour.
Yep.
And I was paying $40 an hour for a Cessna 152 with an instructor. But even at today's dual rates, I think that, you know, with the difference in what you can make in a part-time job as a young person, you know, those ratios are about the same. Even though I'm very bothered that flying is as expensive as it is, I think you can still manage to do that. And through programs like our scholarship, you know, there's other vehicles out there to help you get started flying as well.
That's right. I remember when I started flying, I was making $33 a week.
Okay.
Well, you know, I tell especially my kids, and I used to pay $9 dual.
Mm-hmm.
That included the airplane and the instructor. But that was almost a third of my salary.
Yeah. You really have to have a drive. You really have to have a desire to want to be a pilot. And that's, I think, what's really important for us to communicate to young people is to instill that sense of you know, I really have this burning passion to fly.
Yeah.
And if you have that, there are opportunities out there.
Like I was talking with Diego a little while ago, I feel that a passion is like a fire and a spark, and once you have that spark and once you have the achievements that you feel, it's just the fuel to keep it going and make it bigger and brighter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Yeah, and you need to chase that. And like I said, the benefits that you get through the sciences and through understanding the weather, I mean, you're going to learn skills that you're going to use regardless of where you go.
It changes. I know it changed me. I started flying at a very young age, and it does changes you. I mean, you start, the discipline comes. And I was actually, we were interviewing some cadets here from England just in the previous segment, and whether you're in the military or not, the discipline of flying changes you.
Yes, and you have a bigger sense of the world. I fly my airplane to work. I use it like a car. You know, I just live in Winter Haven. It takes me 12 minutes, 11 minutes and 59 seconds to fly to work, but I still get in my airplane and fly to work.
Wow.
And you get used to the fact that you can have a bigger radius. Flying to New Orleans from here is not that big of a deal in your own airplane. And there's a big perception that it's expensive and you can't partake in that. And that's one of the things I love breaking down in people's perceptions, because you see people with two Harley Davidsons, you see people with an RV, you see people with a bass boat, and they look at you and say, oh, you must be rich, you have an airplane. And then I look at them and I say, well, you must be really rich. And I just had this conversation the other day with someone. I asked them how much their Harley Davidson cost, and they said $24,000. And I looked at him and said, well, that's interesting. My Cessna 120 cost $14,500.
That's correct. That's correct.
And it cost me $30 an hour to fly.
Exactly.
And I can go to New Orleans. I can, you know, I have a very large radius of weekend trips that I can take. And so the perceptions, the airplane literally costs $30 an hour. If you look at someone who operates an RV, and they drag that RV across the country, and they pay the insurance, and they pay the maintenance, and they pay the fuel, which uses more fuel than my airplane.
Yes.
it's more expensive to use an RV.
Some of them
than
are like 6-7 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, per gallon. Yeah. 6-7 miles, depending on the size.
So it's more expensive to operate that RV than it is to have an airplane and operate an airplane.
So it just becomes a part of your daily life and
it
your
does.
Daily yeah. routine.
And it's been so good to me. We physically got married in an airplane in flight.
I heard that. That was first time I ever heard that.
Yeah. We got married in a Grumman Albatross. We had 6 Grumman Albatrosses in the water at our wedding. And we did the ceremony over the Grand Canyon.
Oh my God.
Which was really something. And the only way you could get there was by seaplane or boat. And so we had 20 airplanes in the water at the wedding. And then I subsequently went and did my albatross type rating. And we have flown seaplanes and airplanes from Alaska. I've circumnavigated Australia. This year we're going to Italy to fly seaplanes. So you literally, everywhere you travel, everywhere you go, there's generally a seaplane base or someone that you can go fly with. And I like to tell people to take advantage. Go fly with a different instructor. Fly a different type of airplane that you haven't flown before, because every time you fly a different kind of airplane, you become a better pilot.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And originally, if you go back in history, a lot of the airplanes in the early days were seaplanes.
They were, and especially during World War II and pre-World War II, because there wasn't the network of developed land runways that we have today. And so the demise of seaplanes in many ways historically, and while they've been very popular all along, the military used them very prolifically until we started building runways across the South Pacific Islands and things like that. But
my first boss, as a flight instructor, he owned a school in New York many, many years ago, and he was the flight engineer in the first Pan Am Clipper.
Oh, super.
From New York to Paris. I believe it was 1935, 1936, when that
flight would have been the right,
Yep.
Wow.
And then he was the flight engineer in the first 707 flight from New York to Paris.
Super.
And Pan Am also.
Yeah.
And he had a mock-up of the flight engineers board on the Clipper. Very interesting, and a lot of stories, because he flew all over the world.
Wonderful
back in those
airplane.
Airplanes. And they were all water to water.
Yeah, and there's none of those airplanes left today.
Nope.
And I've had the very good fortune, I've become very good friends with Igor Sikorsky, the grandson of Igor Sikorsky. Who
Connecticut.
Out of Connecticut. Yeah. He now lives in Maine. Yeah. But, you know, Igor was not only did he invent the helicopter, but he was very prolific in all forms of aviation, and he designed many of the large airplanes that Pan Am used that were seaplanes.
I had an opportunity to go there because I did most of my training in Jersey and most of my teaching in Jersey.
Oh, super.
And we used to go to Sikorsky Airport.
Okay, super.
And do a lot of instrument work. Steve, unfortunately, we have reached that time
it's okay.
where we have to say goodbye.
It goes so fast.
I'll tell you, man, when you're having fun. There's nothing better than talking about airplanes, I'll tell you what. Yeah. But we really appreciate you being here,
Diego,
Michelle
thank you.
And I.
Michelle, thank you.
Yes.
And maybe we'll come back and talk some more.
Whenever. The doors are always, you look, no doors. You just come in and sit down,
okay.
And we'll take it from there.
Thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. Please visit our studio website to hear past programs.